You've just landed inside Launch Street, the innovation podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate and differentiate
and get further faster in this crazy cluttered world.
And now, innovation thought leader
and your super fly host,
Tamara Kleinberg.
So here's the deal. On this interview, I have the good fortune of talking to Steven Shapiro, who is an innovation thought leader. So he plays a lot in the same space that I do, which is super cool to hang out with people who come from like-minded places. And he also wrote this great book called Best Practices Are Stupid. I highly suggest that you go pick it up. We dig into it. It's so good. This interview, if you're one of those intrapreneurs out there in our community, and I know there's thousands of you, I think you're going to love this one because we talk a lot about culture of innovation, which is so important. And if you're an entrepreneur or a solopreneur out there, I want you to think about what he says when it comes to the conversation around when you should innovate, how you should innovate, and what good innovation really looks like. All right, what can I say but enjoy? If you can't tell, I'm smiling a little bit. So I am here with Mr. Shapiro, who is one of the foremost authorities on innovation, culture, and collaboration, which we are going to dig into. So over the past 20 years, his message to audiences in 50 countries has focused on how to enable innovation by bringing together divergent points of view in an efficient manner. And those are two things that you don't often hear together. So I can't wait to dig into that. During a 15-year tenure with the consulting firm Accenture, which by the way means he actually practices innovation, doesn't just talk about it, which I think is important, he led a 20,000, and I'm not saying that wrong, right? 20,000 person innovation practice. Oh my God, that's a lot of people. So since branching out on his own in 2001, he has authored 5 books, and his latest, which is the one I just read and we're gonna dig into a little bit, is Best Practices Are Stupid, 40 Ways to Out-Innovate the Competition. It was named the best innovation and creativity book of 2011 and is an international number one bestseller. Steven has been featured in Newsweek, Entrepreneur Magazine, Success Magazine, O, the Oprah Magazine, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, ABC News, and all across the globe. So Steven, thank you so much for joining me. I'm so excited to have you.
It's my pleasure. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm thrilled. So I have a lot of questions I want to dig into, but before I do that, now that the Innovation Roundtable group knows a bit about you, why don't you fill in the gaps of kind of who you are and what you're working on now?
Sure. Well, it's interesting, but I think very few people start off wanting to work on innovation. I got into innovation, it was in 1995. At that time, and I know you asked me what I'm working on now, but I figured I'd just go back because I think it gives some context. In 1995, when I was at Accenture, I was one of the co-leaders of our business process reengineering practice. So for those of you who remember that, it was about downsizing, really. I mean, it was optimization. And so what happened was the work that I was promoting resulted in literally, you know, tens if not hundreds of thousands of people losing their job. And I woke up one morning and said, I can't do this.
Yeah.
I took a leave of absence and decided I'm going to focus on growth, help companies grow their businesses. And basically, that's what I've done for the past 20 years. And my rule of thumb is I won't work with anybody where my work will have even one person lose their job. So for me, that's my driving force behind innovation. It's about growth. It's not just innovation for innovation's sake.
So I want to dig into that a little bit. So you know, innovation, as I'm sure you know, in all your years of doing it, is one of those things where I find that, like, in the good years, it becomes a priority. In the bad years, people kind of close off and don't focus on it. But what I hear you saying is, really, it's something that needs to happen all the time. But without that end result of, because it's about closing in and sucking in, right?
Yeah. If you only innovate during the good years, then basically you're always going to go through an episodic, cyclical type of business, which is not really going to be sustainable in the long run because it's going to be two steps forward, two steps back. The companies that are most successful, the ones that have figured out a way to innovate constantly, even during tough times. In fact, what we know is that innovation during tough times gives you a greater return on your investment because everybody else is pulling back. So for every dollar you spend, you get $2 of return as opposed to in more competitive times. So I think it's important. It's also, I guess it's important to understand what I mean by innovation. It's not about the products. I mean, we get so caught up in the product. To me, it's about adaptability. Mm. It's about recognizing that the marketplace is changing, customers are changing, demographics are changing. And if we don't adapt, we lose.
So I'm going to jump ahead in one of my questions because what you said is intriguing. In your book, you said, and I wrote it down just to make sure I didn't get it wrong, and I think it speaks to what you're saying, which is when the pace of change outside your organization is greater than the pace of change within, you will be eaten. So
yes.
I want you to expand on, first of all, a couple of things. What is, number one, how do you know if I'm a leader in an organization, how do I know that's what I'm dealing with? And number two, what are really the consequences of that? Because I think you're dead on. I mean, that's in innovation. We see that a lot where all this stuff is happening out here, but the minute you walk in those doors, it's a whole different situation.
Well, I think the challenge is that our balance sheets and everything else are really just lagging indicators.
Mm-hmm.
So what we really need to recognize is that by the time it becomes, you know, common in the market to do something, it's too late because it's going to take us so long to catch up.
Right.
So we need to be constantly sensing what types of changes are taking place. You know, I don't want to be the person who jumps on the millennial bandwagon with everyone else, but if you look at that, you know, companies who just sort of are now addressing it are way behind the curve. But it's also, you don't want to generalize. So I think what happens is a trend will happen, we'll hop on the bandwagon, we'll innovate around that, and then all of a sudden we realize, well, maybe it wasn't quite what we thought it was. So it's really that nimbleness that I think is so important.
So how do you know then when it's something you should or shouldn't pay attention to on the front end? Because I do find that that takes a particular ability to recognize and connect the dots in new and meaningful ways. So how do you, when you work with companies, how do you help them figure that out?
Well, I think the first step for any company is to recognize that you need to focus on your differentiator. I always say innovate where you differentiate.
Yeah.
So you can't solve every problem. Now, what you need to do is solve whatever relevant issues there are in the marketplace in your own unique way. And so when we partner with people, when I partner with universities, when I partner with think tanks, I'm actually less interested in the solutions that they provide. Mm-hmm. Which is why a lot of companies work with universities. I'm actually much more interested in the trends. What's happening that's going to impact us? And the main reason for this is because as human beings, we have blind spots.
Mm-hmm.
And basically the past, especially if we had a successful past, will be the cause of a future failure.
Right.
So the key is to just recognize that.
So if I'm a leader, how do I mean, it sounds kind of obvious, but I don't know, and I don't know if this happens to you, but oftentimes when I work with people, I do find that they don't realize the difference between what's happening in the marketplace versus what's happening inside their organization. So what are the symptoms that you see when you talk to people that makes you go, wow, this is the crux of your challenge here, is that you're not at the same pace of what's going on outside?
I think part of it is when you see that everybody is thinking the same way. So when you had the introduction for me, it's like, we need to recognize that breakthroughs never come from experts in a particular domain of expertise. They always come from somewhere else. And so when we start, you know, eating our own dog food, if you want to use the Silicon Valley term, or if you want, but the more we start doing that, I mean, in theory, that means that we're destined to fail because we need to always be looking at what's happening outside. So if we're like, hey, everybody's agreeing and we're doing the same things and we're building on the past and only the past, to me, that's one sign of future failure. And there's just, you know, there's so many examples of this. And so the key is to just recognize that we need to have some people who play devil's advocate for the company, who are there to basically show that everything the company is doing is actually wrong. And there's a quote from Scott Cook at Intuit. I think it's probably one of the best quotes as it relates to innovation. He said, "For each of our failures, we had spreadsheets that looked awesome."
That's great.
And
that's fantastic.
I wish I had said that.
Right.
But I think that's really so true, is we get so caught up in what we think is right, and then confirmation bias kicks in the brain.
Yeah.
And it's really the brain. The brain is our biggest enemy.
Yeah. Well, and I think you really nailed it when you said success yesterday is not success today. And in fact, oftentimes it's not, because the marketplace is different, the timing is different, everything is different than it was yesterday. So I want to back up and ask you a question about the book, because one of the things that I really appreciated about it you're a great storyteller, but on top of that, the end of the story were surprising. So like, I started with the intro about the oil spill and them collecting ideas, and my first thought was, oh yeah, that was great. And then you went into why it wasn't great, and I was like, oh wait, no, it wasn't. And then you mentioned kind of the Google thing about 20%, you know, they get 20% to do whatever they want, but really that's a recruiting tool, not a you don't really get the ideas from that thing, but we all think of those and you hear it out in the world, those kind of best practices, but you took it to a whole nother level of saying, hey, wait a minute, actually, if you look at those things, they don't, they suck, right? To use the title of the book, they suck. So
well, I just said stupid.
Oh, stupid. Oh, I said suck. I'll say suck then. You're much nicer than I am then. But, you know, but we hear that, right? That's the myth out there is, oh, well, we should do it like Google and Apple and, you know, this example and that. So I'm curious how you came to that realization, not just why you put pen to paper, but how that angle, that perspective from you came about.
I mean, it's, look, I've been doing this for a long time. I've gone into companies. The first thing that I noticed is that companies that thought they were doing the right thing based on everything they've read, everything they've been told, wasn't working. And so I just really had to take a hard look at even the type of advice I was once giving. It's like, okay, am I really, like, am I just getting caught up in, you know, what seems to be conventional wisdom? But maybe that's not the right answer. And so when I started to really look at what had companies be successful, it was never about ideas. Ideas actually, I'm a big believer that creativity has killed innovation. Mm-hmm. Because what happens is creativity is all about, hey, let's get ideas. There's no bad ideas. Let's get lots of ideas. Let's
generate,
and you drown.
Generate.
You're drowning in a sea of bad ideas. And then even the good ideas can't be extracted from it. So that was one thing which I noticed. The other thing which I noticed is we get so caught up in solutions. Hey, we're working on this project. We can go do this. We can go do that. I've got this idea. Let's go implement it. We never stepped back and asked, what's the question? Hmm. And there's a fortune cookie I once got. When I talk about innovation, I always show this fortune cookie. It says, you always have the right answers. They just sometimes ask the wrong questions.
Yeah,
yeah. And I think, you know, a nice little tasty treat had some pretty brilliant wisdom there.
Who knew?
I really believe that that is the crux of most innovation failure, is the lack of understanding the process of asking better questions.
Yeah. So I find that fascinating, partially because, you know, so I spent years doing innovation in a little bit of a different way than you did. And a lot of that is also wrapped up in market research and talking to customers. And one of the things that I found was that going into a project with any company, most of my work was in consumer packaged goods, but it's probably kind of a universal truth in a lot of ways for my work, is that they were asking the customers the wrong questions as well. At least they thought what they wanted to ask them or what they wanted to dig into really weren't the right places to dig into. And you talk about it, not just from that perspective, but also from the, are you asking the right question in terms of, are you solving the right challenge too? So what is a just right challenge in your mind? How do you know you're asking the right thing, and how do you know you're tapping the right people to get it done, to get it answered?
So, and there are two different questions that you're asking.
They're jumbled.
Itself, and then the other one is the answer. And I like to put a pause button between the question and the answer.
Yeah.
In terms of the question, first of all, my one rule of thumb I use is what I call the Goldilocks principle, which is basically Goldilocks and Three Bears goes into a house, one bed's too soft. Mm-hmm. One bed's too hard, one's just right. And when we ask questions, we tend to have two default mechanisms for asking questions. They're either going to be too abstract, which is sort of like the soft bed.
Right.
How am I going to improve productivity? How do I increase sales? How do I increase, you know, improve margins? We ask these abstract questions, and the thing that we know is if you ask abstract questions, you get abstract and fluffy answers.
Yeah.
And this is the downside of a lot of suggestion boxes. And so we know that doesn't work. On the flip side, a lot of times we have ones which are too detailed, too specific, or too hard in the bed analogy. And that's where we have solutions masquerading as questions, or they're questions that are limiting in terms of the ability to find solutions in other areas. Coming back to something I said before, breakthroughs almost never come from an expert in a particular domain. So it's finding that sweet spot in between it. And then I've identified 70 different ways that you can reframe a question. None of the 70 lead to the right question. It's really a matter of experimentation with the question to see what types of responses you get.
So can we walk through that, how this might work?
Sure.
Because I think it's so, I think it's so important for the people listening to really understand the power of the question, because you know, to what you're saying, I believe that innovation is often in the questions, it's not in the answers. And it's in it when you're asking the right thing. So I'm gonna throw you on the spot right now, but let's say, So let's say for the Shook, for my organization, so let's say the lofty goal would be, how do we up our subscriber base? How do we up our community? Yeah. How would we then go about making that something that's actually useful for us in our pursuit of growth?
Okay, so the first question I would ask is that really even the objective you want? In some cases, you know, having more people is less important than having fewer relevant people.
Yeah, the right people.
So that's, to me, the first question is, you know, what is really the right mix there, the right number of people that we're looking to get? I would also look at, who are the right people? So as part of that is, instead of just trying to get 1,000 or 10,000 people that are sort of generic and may or may not be part of the tribe that you're looking to create, who are the right people? And that sometimes takes some data. So one of the things we know about asking questions is, you can't just sit around a table and say, hey, this is the answer. A lot of times what we need to do is get more information. Questions force us to ask more questions, to dig deeper. And so I'd really want to understand, well, what are your overall business objectives? Like people who sell books, like how do I sell more books? Maybe the question isn't how do I sell more books, but how do I leverage the book to be able to sell something that's maybe a higher
value?
How
do I get into the right person's hands?
And who's the right person? Like, am I really selling books? Am I selling podcasts? Or am I selling services? Or am I selling products? And so it really needs to fit in with the overall objective of what we're trying to create.
You know, oftentimes what I see is organizations will, when they get into the, when innovation becomes their priority, so assuming it's, you know, I mean, if it's a full-time process for them, great, but they put up this wall between them and their customers. So they do all this work internally and then they lob the tennis ball, you know, the idea over the wall, and it's a one-way tennis match because, you know, the customer on the other side is ducking and weaving because they never really engage them. And you, I had a really good chuckle because you talk a little bit about ethnographies, and I have spent more hours in the back of cars and at people's dining room tables. And I will just tell you, aside from sitting in a Camaro for a two-hour commute in the Bay Area with my knees up here, I one time went into a house, we were doing healthy cereal, was the topic, it was for General Mills. And the woman was going on about how healthy she was, which was great, but there was a deep fryer on her counter, like out, you know, like you put the equipment out that you use, and she's pouring sugar in her cornflakes as she's telling us how healthy she is. And I don't think she's a liar. I think that's her perception of what health looks like. So it was such a, when you talked about ethnographies, I just started laughing aloud of, wow, it's so true. You got to get people out of focus groups and you got to understand who your customer really is. And I've got to imagine in your world, you have great stories about the difference just that little thing makes for innovation.
Well, absolutely. And I think, but here's the important point also, I love that example. I mean, that's absolutely brilliant. A lot of times we're even asking the wrong customer. So I always like to step back to, again, differentiation. To me, differentiation is something that sets you apart from everyone else, and that's the reason why someone does business with you. And it's not price, but it's something else that's difficult for someone else to replicate. It's easily understood in the marketplace, and it is something that is valued by the market. So, and you can create it. So I work in the hospitality industry, and if you think about hospitality industry, for example, you know, one hotel chain has probably done better than any other hotel chain in terms of claiming they have the best beds.
Is that the W?
Well, it's
close?
Starwoods. It would be part of that whole chain. So
yeah,
it's
close then. Winner.
Well, it's all the Starwood properties have the heavenly beds. So the W's and the Westons, and they've done a brilliant job at that.
Yeah.
Are their beds the best? No, they're not the best. So we can create this conversation in the market. And so my point on this, though, is we need to get clear on how we want to differentiate.
Right.
But we need to understand that differentiation is not a reality. It is a conversation in the marketplace.
Yeah.
And so what we need to do is not just talk to our current customers, but we need to talk to people who are past customers that left us. And we also need to find a way of getting access to people who we've never done business with. And we need to triangulate to better understand how we are positioned in the marketplace so that we can leverage that in the future as a distinguishing factor.
So you're a great storyteller. Give us a story around that, because it is a hard thing for people to, as obvious as it sounds to you and maybe to me, it's a hard thing to swallow to do. Let's talk to the people who aren't our customers right now. Because it feels like a waste of money to some people. And I'm not saying it is. I'm saying that's that's what I've heard people say. And I don't disagree with you, but give me some stories around that, because I think if people can wrap their heads around why that's so important, they can start to move in that direction.
Sure. I'll give you a story that I love, which is, it's not a client of mine, fortunately. but it tells you the challenge of only talking to people who are interested in what you have to offer.
Yeah.
It's the Revel Casino in Atlantic City. So I don't know if you're familiar with the story of Revel. But
I mean, not a lot, but I know who they are.
Well, so the Revel Casino, I love Atlantic City.
Good to know.
It is. Well, look, where can you go sit on the beach and have a great time and then go to a casino? So the Revel Casino was built in 2012. And what they basically did was they decided we're going to create this high-end, sophisticated casino, and it cost them $2.5 billion.
Wow.
$2.5 billion in 2012. And so they decided, we know what the market wants. We're not going to ask people. We're going to create a market. And some people sort of get, you know, they hear Steve Jobs in their head. Yeah. Oh, we don't. That's baloney. You need to know what people want. You can't just.
Well, he knew. He didn't make it. He knew.
And there was, and it came out that they actually did studies, and so they weren't just guessing here.
Right.
So the Revel Casino. The reason why I think this is such a great example is they created what they thought was the perfect casino. It was high end, sophisticated, and classy. The only problem was, the people who go to Atlantic City
are not high-end, sophisticated, and classy. I lived in New York. I know. I've been there.
they go to the beach with their kids. They eat hot dogs and cotton candy.
Right.
I mean, that woman who's putting sugar on her cornflakes would be healthy compared to the average person there. And they, you know, so they were talking to the wrong people. They were getting the wrong sense of where to go. And in 2014, it went bankrupt, closed the doors, and the Revel Casino's no more. So, look, if you don't talk to people who aren't your customers, who could be, should be your customers, you're getting a very distorted picture.
Yeah. Well, in some ways, too, I think you fall prey to drinking the Kool-Aid, too, which I think we see sometimes where they start to believe that everything they do is right, their product is amazing, their service is amazing, their business is amazing, but it's because they're only talking to a small group of people and not to a broader group to understand why they're not coming.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I really find it interesting, even like with Apple. We'll see how Apple does in 10 years. And look, I'm an Apple fanatic, but I'm not blind to, you know, other products that come out that might be better. And I think what happens is sometimes the fanaticism of Apple customers sometimes blinds Apple to what they're actually doing.
Well, and I think we saw that a couple of years ago when we saw the influx of Samsung and some other competitors that we would have a year prior said, nobody can touch Apple. And all of a sudden, there were these viable competitors that were closing that chasm between them.
Right.
Yeah. So talk a little more about differentiation. You know, you say, you talk about in your book about you can't play, you're not going to win playing somebody else's game.
Right.
So how do you figure out your game? And maybe that's everything we've just been talking about. But, you know, to me, it's you can either add to the noise or you can you know, rise above it. You can either play in somebody else's space, which frankly is not that interesting, fun, or viable, or you can create your own space. So how do you get to that place where you create your own space, especially if you're a larger organization where you might already be in catch-up mode without even realizing it?
Well, and I think everything you said is just right. You need to rise above the noise. And we have talked about it. To me, it really is about understanding, why do people do business with you? Mm-hmm. Why do they do business with someone else? If someone else is already doing their bigger, better, and faster than you, then you need to find something else that's going to distinguish you from them.
Yeah.
And but what I find very interesting, it's not an easy process to give in a soundbite in terms of how you determine that. But there is certainly a process to it. But to me, what becomes very interesting then is what you do with it. Because the problem is, a lot of times a differentiator is confused with a vision or a mission or something like that, and it's not. I mean, it really is something which you use to operationalize your innovation strategy. And so I have a framework that I talk about where basically if I look at every single activity that every person in an organization does, falls into three categories. It's either support in nature, which means that it's something which the customers in the market don't value, but you probably need to do it potentially.
Right.
Payroll. Got to pay people.
Right, right.
But you're not going to innovate your payroll system. That makes no sense.
Right.
So there you want to outsource. You want to eliminate it if you possibly can, or at least minimize it. So support is not where you want to be innovating. That's where you're going to be outsourcing and streamlining the heck out of it. It's the next two levels that I think get interesting, though. It's the core, which are the table stakes. It's what people expect. You need to do it. If you don't do it well, you're going to be out of business. And a lot of times when you look at where companies are investing, they're innovating their core.
Right.
But that means they're basically putting money into the noise, essentially. So there, to me, it's about partnerships. It's about optimization. It's about Six Sigma. It is about best practices, because you don't have to be the best. You just have to be really good at it. And what we found is when we use this model, we can free up. One of the big issues with innovation is not having enough time to innovate. This model frees you up. We've been able to double, triple, quadruple the amount of time they have to innovate by changing their strategy. So to me, that's why it's so important. And again, it's not an easy process, but it's a conversation with the market.
Don't you think that that myth of it takes time to innovate is kind of ridiculous, though? I mean, I get that to do big projects and initiatives, that takes resources and time. But the flip side to that is if we're not innovating, we're actually working harder and longer and with less impact. I always find that like that it doesn't, when people say to me, oh, it's so hard tomorrow, I think, yeah, but what you're doing is actually in the long run harder and more work.
Well, I'm always a big believer that laziness, if laziness is the father of innovation. So necessity is the mother of invention.
Yeah.
And laziness is the father. And so, I mean, I think you're right. We need to, and laziness, though, in the eyes of the consumer, if you're B2C, because we need to really just recognize that people are consuming information, consuming everything in a different way today, and they don't want it to be the way it used to be. So it has to be made simpler. To me, simplification is the best innovation. But that's we've got in our mind that sometimes innovation is to make things more complex. So you're right. Innovation, I mean, it takes time, obviously, but it's not as big as people think.
Yeah.
It's more like being a surgeon with a scalpel to remove the things that aren't necessary rather than just trying to be an engineer and throw more things on top of it.
Right. And to your point, if you have the data and you're asking the right questions, the innovation will become a lot clearer, a lot faster as well. I think it's when you are throwing anything up onto the wall and hoping one of those things stick that you tend to get, to your point, kind of bogged down, or you know, it drowns out what could be the good ideas.
Yeah. And I just want to share with you a story that I don't think is in the book, but I love this example. And I always talk about it during my speeches because I think it's very eye-opening. And it's, I mean, I know you're like I am. You travel a lot, and probably one of the things you never like having to do is to wait for baggage claim.
Yes.
You know, because that's torturous.
It's a waste of time.
It is. You talk about a waste of time. So there's this one airport where they did the studies, and they found that it took 15 to 20 minutes for the bags to get from the plane to the baggage carousel. And people are complaining that's a little too long. So they did what most good innovators would do. They took to the task of speeding up the bags.
Yeah.
And they spent a ton of money on faster conveyor belts and new technology and more baggage handlers, cut it in half, down to 8 to 10 minutes, ready to declare it a success. They find out the passengers are still annoyed.
They're still angry because they're in baggage claim.
Because they're in baggage claim. So, and here was the issue. The issue wasn't how fast the bags were. It took 8 to 10 minutes for the bags to get from the plane to the baggage claim area. The issue was it took the passengers only 1 to 3 minutes to get from the plane to the baggage claim. So instead of speeding up the bags, they slowed down the passengers.
You know, that's such a great story. And you know what's funny about that is because I do travel a lot, and I often don't check because I don't want to have to deal with going to baggage claim.
Right.
But if I do check and I'm on Southwest, for example, I will happily go to the back of the plane because the idea of taking a little longer from my seat to the baggage claim is better than standing in the baggage claim.
And it's so true.
It's
it's the psychology of the question too.
Yeah.
Because they were solving speeding up the bag when in fact the problem they should have solved is wait time.
Right.
Wait time and the speed of a bag is not the same thing. And so if you spend your entire life trying to speed up bags, you're never going to think to slow down passengers. People experience wait time differently than they do walk time. So you're absolutely right. But this, I love this example because it really gets quite simply that you can be working your butt off trying to make bags make the bags faster, and you will never get to a satisfactory resolution.
So I mean, there's a lot of content in this conversation and a lot of great takeaways, but I think for those people who are listening, if you could take away one thing, it's to really think through the questions you're asking and the challenges you're trying to solve. Because if you are, I think you say in the book in a similar way, but if you are answering this question, you could go down a whole path that has nothing to do with what success is going to look like. And you're going to spend a lot of time and money on a path that doesn't actually help you, like the baggage claim. That's such a great example.
Well, I always say, don't think outside the box. find a better box. The issue isn't the expansiveness of your thinking. The issue is you're looking in the wrong place.
Yeah.
And so I think that's really just an important point. And what we've found, we've actually done studies in companies, that when you shift to what I would call a challenge-centered innovation mindset, where instead of it's about ideas and suggestions and opinions, we move it to employees and customers in the market solving important problems, we increase the ROI in innovation a minimum of tenfold.
Wow.
So it's a simple shift, yet it has a massive impact. And as you said, that takes less time to do it right.
Well, this is why I can't stand the, like, I don't have time to make innovation a priority, because I think you're spending more time on that. It's like if you don't have a place to put your keys every day, you spend all this time looking for your keys every morning, when if you had just done it right the first time, you wouldn't have wasted all that energy later. And I'm not saying that that's me every morning. I'm just saying it's possible that I lose my keys every single morning. Let's talk about failure.
Okay.
So I'm not a fan of the, like, let's love our failures. Let's wrap them up in a pretty bow. And, you know, failure is good. And that's the conversation oftentimes out there in the marketplace. It's the current of, we should love our failures, love our failures. And you talk a little bit about failure, actually quite a bit really, about failure in your book. So talk about it from your perspective, because I don't think it matches the, like, yay, failure is good.
Well, you and I are totally got a little Vulcan mind meld
right here.
I think failure is a terrible thing.
Yeah, I do too.
Because if we do it right, we should not be failing. And I have several different perspectives on it, but sort of the first one is that we should be thinking about innovation through the lens of experimentation.
Yeah.
And experiments only fail when you don't prove or disprove a hypothesis. Mm-hmm. And the biggest mistake that I think we make, and that's the Scott Cook quote, I thought was, you know, really describes it well, is we conduct experiments. We think they're experiments. Unfortunately, and there's a couple of activities that I do with my clients, which really gets them to see this, is that we always conduct experiments that are designed to confirm what we believe.
Yep. It's like watching the news channel that you agree to.
Exactly. That's a perfect example. Yeah. So what we need to do is become masterful at creating experiments that are specifically designed to disprove everything we believe to be true. We need to have those devil advocates, because, you know, we always say the yeah, but is the enemy of innovation. It's not. It's the wow, this is a great idea. That's the enemy of innovation, because we get so attached to it that we drive it forward, push it forward, especially if you're a top executive and you push it forward and you spend a lot of money and it fails.
I love the way you said that about what, you know, yeah, but is actually not the enemy. And in fact, I think the people that poke holes and the experiments that poke holes are our greatest friend, because they show us what's really possible and not possible and what we need to improve and not improve. But, you know, I think we make the mistake of someone. So if you said to me tomorrow, I don't think it'll work, because I shut down, I call you a yes butter and I move on to the next person. So on a personal level, we tend to do that. And it sounds like you're saying too, on a process level, we actually do that as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean,
and that's unfortunately what has happened. I said creativity is killing innovation. I think what's happened is we have inside of organizations seem to have embraced the yes and people and the creative wackadoodles. And I'm one of those. But
you need everybody else.
But we need everybody else. And that's why the book before Best Practices Are Stupid was Personality Poker, which is actually a card game which gets you to recognize that the person you like the least, the person who annoys you the most, is the person you actually need the most.
Totally.
Because they will compliment you with an E, compliment you with an E, your need to get things done. And so we need these, you know, yes, but people, but use them in the right way. It's so important.
Right. And that is right. They need to be used in the right way, both in terms of where they are and how they're engaged in the process and how you communicate with them.
Yes.
I talk a lot about the language of innovation, and they're the ones I focus on, because I think they're so critical. And by the way, I have played personality poker years ago at an NSA conference. So I think it's an awesome game, and it really enlightening. You're like, wow, look at that. Look what personality I am. So hold on, let me go back to my questions, because I want to make, I even highlighted because I was so excited to ask about a few things. My God, where is it? Oh, I wanted to ask about the behaviors. Where is it? Ah, hold on. Oh, measurements. That's what I wanted to ask about. Okay, so thank you. I wanted to make sure there were some questions that I just had to cover. So, you know, I'm a big fan of measuring. I love it for a lot of reasons, mostly because I like to see patterns in the data and I like to understand if we think something's working or not working. I don't really tend to use success versus failure because that's so final. So to kind of your point, right, it's all about experimentation. But you bring up the point that sometimes that measurement actually creates unwanted behaviors and outcomes. So dig a little bit into that, because I think we're so of like, if you can't, what is that Peter Drucker quote? If you know, you can only manage what you measure. But I feel like there's an and or a but, and then what Stephen puts in there.
Well, I always say you'll get what you measure, but will you get what you want?
That's what it is. Yeah.
And you know, there's everything we do, there are always unintended consequences to it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think the thing to understand is, first of all, human beings aren't stupid, so we are going to do things to optimize whatever's going to look best for us, even if it screws over everyone else. Mm-hmm. It's just a natural human behavior, and we can think that we're going to be all kumbaya and big business, but a lot of, look, when you've got bills to pay and mouths to feed,
yeah,
we're going to take a different slant on it. So what's going to happen is our measurement systems have unintended consequences. Mm. And so if we're so focused on particular parts of the business, for example, so we'll try to optimize one aspect of the entire pipeline or one of the processes, it may, in some respects, cause problems with other pieces, which is why, like some work that we've done in product development, we've redefined product development. So like product development used to be, we've been able to develop the product, you know, R&D, right, create something, we've got the prototype, and it's ready to be able to hand it over to manufacturing or whomever it might be. But what happens is they would then hand it over to manufacturing. Manufacturing said, well, we can't manufacture this. So they send it back to R&D. And then they go back and forth. And eventually it's like, well, it goes to the salespeople. Well, it's not exactly what we need to sell, so we have to change it again. Then it goes to legal, and there's some kind of legal IP. And so you go round and round. What we found is if we just redefine the measures and the organization structure that goes with it and redefine product development to be 6 months after product launch, we now get a fundamentally different outcome because everybody's now involved in product development, and right, we just understand what their role is. And we've been able to, you know, basically get an order of magnitude improvement in certain processes simply by redefining the measures and redefining the organization and processes that go with those measures.
Do you find that the measures are both kind of within the process and then also in the outcome? So I'll give you an example. I was working with a food company, and they had a joint venture with a European company. They wanted to bring their product over here. And the challenge that I was finding is that the measurement for success was the same level as their base brands. So their base brands, of course, are up here. They've had 20 years to develop. And then this new venture, particularly in the new product area, right? This new product came in, and it wasn't given the time to get here. So very quickly, they called it a failure because I think their measurement was incorrect for a new product, and it got canned. So I want to get your thoughts on that, because that's always bothered me, that the milestones and the measurements that companies tend to make particularly when you're talking about new inventions or new innovations, they tend to use old measurements that don't apply.
Well, I'm not sure there's much for me to add to that, because I totally agree with what you're saying. I'm a big believer that expertise is the enemy of all aspects of innovation. So whether it's the measures we've used in the past leading to the future, the solutions we've used in the past leading to, so it's, to me, it's all part of the same, is our past doesn't stay in the past. Our past ends up in the future, which then causes us a lot of problems. And, you know, I'm thinking about a story, which is a slight tangent, but yeah. I remember I was working with a client just in terms of measures. It's a sporting goods apparel company, can't get into too many details, but they were at this event and they had a goal of selling $1 million of product at this event.
At like a trade show event thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And can't get into too many details, but $1 million.
Understood.
And they were being incented to, they were given bonuses if they did it. And like almost immediately, they got to like 900,000.
Wow.
But that last 100,000, they were struggling to get to. They spent basically 10 times what it took them to get to the 900,000 to get to the million. They lost money in the end because million was the target, not 900. If they were 900,000, they would have rocked it. They would have been profitable. But they had the wrong measure.
Right.
And so it incentivized everybody to do something which was actually extremely dysfunctional.
Right. So they ended up losing money, and that 100,000 in sales cost them more than the 900,000 total,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. And people get bonuses. So we incentivized people to do something which was actually quite dysfunctional.
Right.
And that does, you know, and so we'll get what we measure. We'll get that $1 million, but we didn't really get what we wanted, which was, I mean, it was more, part of it was just market share and awareness. So it wasn't just about money, but that extra 100,000 wasn't really that important in the scheme of things.
Although if the measure is market awareness, that's a whole different,
question.
That's a whole different question and a whole different angle that you would take to achieve that too.
Different way to achieve it, different methods. And I would even say that the measures would be different. Maybe the million wasn't the measure. Maybe it's just the number of people who they touched.
Right.
Some other kind of aspect. Maybe it's things that they gave away. Whatever it is, the measures are going to give you the outcomes in many cases because we tend to reverse engineer consciously or subconsciously. We reverse engineer that measure to a process that we're going to follow.
So are you asking the right questions? Are you focusing on the right challenges? And are you measuring the right things?
Right.
So if you have those three things, you can innovate more successfully, really. I mean, among other things. But
if I can add one more piece to
absolutely.
It. Absolutely. I think I always say you want to ask the right questions, which is about differentiation, the right way, which is don't think outside the box, find a better box. And then the next piece is to the right people. And this is where we get at expertise being the enemy of innovation.
Right.
And I'm not going to bore you with stories because I've got 1,000 stories of companies that were stuck trying to solve a problem. And only by changing the question so that it looked different. Well, I'll give you one quick.
No, I was like, you can bore me with stories. Come on
I'll give you one quick one. I love this one. It's not necessarily the best invention, but it's the best thought process in the world.
Yeah.
So it's a toothpaste manufacturer in the UK wanted to create a new type of whitening toothpaste. All whitening toothpaste pretty much uses abrasives or bleach.
Yep.
So they had a team of experts, dental experts in their dental care division, working on the problem of how do we make a toothpaste that makes teeth whiter without abrasives or bleach. Spent a ton of money, went around in circles, didn't get anywhere. We're thinking of shutting down the project until one day somebody said, hey, maybe we're asking the wrong question. This isn't exactly how they said it, but they realized they were asking the wrong question. They asked, instead of saying, how do we, the experts, make teeth whiter, they asked the question, who else makes whites whiter?
Right.
And as it turns out, it's laundry detergent.
Yeah.
And also, as it turns out, within this company, they have a laundry detergent division.
Oh, well, there you go.
There you go. In the history of the company, dental care and laundry detergent had never talked to each other. They thought this would be a good time. So they go over and they ask them, hey, you know, when you're not using bleach, how do you make whites whiter? And they were told, we don't. We make whites bluer.
Right.
Laundry detergent is blue. Exactly. It creates an illusion of whiteness. And so they created a whitening toothpaste that has a blue dye in it that creates the illusion of whiteness for 2 to 3 hours. And again, to me, it's that mindset of saying someone else has solved this problem just somewhere else.
Well, that's the key though, right? Just somewhere else.
Yes.
And how great would it be, particularly in the larger organizations that have resources, but it doesn't have to be large, to actually on a regular basis have that those cross-functional teams come together. I mean, think how much time you could save. And I work with a lot of entrepreneurs as well, and I always tell them, if you're going to innovate and you want to kind of figure out how to do it, look at someone who's not in your category who has the same challenge. So I look at for the Shook, I look at actually Tough Mudder and some of those extreme sports because they are brilliant at creating communities. So if I'm going to look at who's doing something innovative, I'm going to look way out there and bring it back. And I think if you're always asking, how do I apply this to my world, you can actually get a lot of innovation by going far and wide. So I'm with you. I mean, I think deep is fine, but I think we have to go wide to get the innovation.
And, you know, Steve Jobs said, we had a couple of different quotes related to dots, but one of them, which I never agreed with, was that you can't look into the future to connect the dots or something like that. I'm getting it wrong, but basically what he's saying is you can't predict what dots will connect. And I don't believe that's true.
Hmm.
I mean, we can if we use the right mindset. So I've got something I call purposeful tangents. And I loved your example that you used because to me that's sort of a form of a purposeful tangent, which is to say it's not about solving a particular problem, but rather – who else is in a completely different domain of expertise where I could learn things from? And there's a group called Pumps and Pipes.
Oh.
I love this group. It's cardiologists who get together basis with people from the gas pipeline industry.
Oh my God, the vision in my head was like high heels and pipes. From there. I was like, I don't know. I mean, I'm open to it, but I don't know how that works.
No, this one is cardiologists talking about the cardiovascular system and people from the gas pipeline industry talking about the transmission of gas. And what they share in common is the transmission of a liquid through a tube.
Yeah.
And there's so many cool developments that have come out of that, where they've learned how, like, you know, you get a paper cut and the finger seals itself, self-coagulation. They now have developed that for gas pipelines based on the way the human body does
it.
It wasn't an oil expert who did that. It was, you know, somebody who works in the biology and cardiovascular system. So those, I think, are just so fascinating. There's so much research from Harvard Business School and 3M and other places that prove that the breakthroughs, the things which create the most value, are never from a single discipline, but are always multidisciplinary in nature.
Yeah, you're talking to the convert on this one, because I'm a big fan of, you know, who else is out there who is, to your point, I like how you said it, purposeful, right? So who else is trying to do what I'm doing, has done it really well, has the same problem I have. I'm not going to look at people in my category, because then we're going to all do it the same way. And I don't want to do that, to your point about differentiation. And I will tell you, I mean, I'm not supposed to share this because it's, you know, some people call it a failure. But at one point with the Shook, we veered into the online retail category, and we were getting creamed because we didn't have a differentiation anymore. And I can't compete in the online category. So that's where online retail. So that's where we really realized that this testing ground was our unique differentiator. But I had to pull it back out. And it's just a great testament to why you can't win at somebody else's game, to what you say.
And we can still learn, as long as it's not the people who are in our direct space.
Yeah. I just don't want to do it like them. I mean, I think that's why Southwest is so brilliant. I think you have the example in your book, and I've talked about it and heard about it before, about them going to the Indy 500 pits.
Right. Yep.
Because, I mean, so brilliant, right? You want to learn how to speed? Go to someone who's mastered speed. Why would you look at other airlines? Because they haven't mastered it.
Exactly.
That's for sure. All right. So I want to be conscious of our time, although I feel like we could keep going. But I'd like to hear some of your favorite total bombs out there. I mean, there are so many, and I do think we're in an interesting point where, as particularly, I don't want to guess your age, for me as a Gen Xer, you know, we saw these big companies that are not even around anymore. I mean, they went from being the dominant market leader like Kodak and Blockbuster, right, all those guys, to just being flat out gone. And it's ironic, because sometimes when I speak, I'll mention them, and some people who are, you know, 30 and under, like, I don't even know who's Blockbuster. And I'm going, oh my God. So I think we're in this interesting time where we can see the difference between the two. So I don't know what my question is there, except I'd love to hear you talk about your take on that.
Well, you basically what you described is how I typically would start off a speech, which is talking about companies that were, you know, we always talk about good to great.
Yeah,
now that's Jim Collins.
Yeah.
But I'm always interested in what happens when great companies are gone.
Right, and there are so many of them that are gone.
There's so many. I mean, like, you couldn't even. I mean, we could spend a whole hour just talking about
right?
them. So my favorites are one is a personal favorite, just because I used to love it as a kid, but it also is from my hometown. Is Howard Johnson's restaurants?
Oh my gosh,
those orange roofs. So
yeah.
good. So here's what people don't realize: in 1965, Howard Johnson's was bigger than Burger King, KFC, and McDonald's combined. They were actually, in the 1960s, the second largest provider of food to Americans. The number one provider of food to Americans was the U.S. Army.
Amazing.
So Howard Johnson's was the dominant player in the food industry. They had 1,000 restaurants. I mean, it was just absolutely unbelievable. There are two Howard Johnson's left, one in upstate New York and one in Maine.
Oh my God.
That's it. So, you know, I love that one because it was the dominant player. Pan Am.
Yeah, Pan Am.
They were the airline industry.
That's right, yeah.
I always start off with, because I think it's just so interesting, is Sears.
Yep.
Because Sears in the 60s was 1% of the U.S. gross national product. I mean, yep. It wasn't just the biggest retailer.
It was
engine. Did you know that in the 1960s, 1 out of 3 Americans had a Sears credit card?
Oh, my gosh.
I ask audiences, okay, how many of you have a Sears credit card? You usually get
nobody.
Like,
Maybe one 60-year-old in the corner.
And here's what I find fascinating about Sears, without getting into all the details and all that, is in 1983, 1984, they were 10 times the size of Walmart. Today, Walmart's 15 times the size of Sears and Kmart combined. But at that time, when they were really at their peak, they also were the largest provider of the internet because they had Prodigy. Prodigy and CompuServe were the first consumer internet offerings out there.
Yeah.
And what I find interesting is because the Sears printed catalog was so successful, even though Sears essentially, you know, commercialized the internet, they were the last one to bring an online catalog because their print catalog was so successful.
They didn't want to get rid of it.
So it's like our past kills us in the future.
Yeah.
And that's the thing which we need to recognize.
That's such a, I had no idea about Howard Johnson. And Sears is a great example. And it's just, I mean, they're just not even here anymore. It is there. And I think now we're used to companies coming and going, but we forget that the big guys can fall really hard too.
I mean, the company I joined out of college was Arthur Andersen.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, that, I mean, there's a whole story behind that too.
They had a really fast fall because they had 85,000 people in 2001 and 200 people in 2002. In 1 year, they vanished. Now, right. Yes, it wasn't just because of competitive issues, but we need to understand that it's perception in the market will drive who buys from us, which is why differentiation is not for us to claim. Your customers determine your differentiator. Yeah. Your customers say how you differentiate. And if people say Arthur Andersen can't be trusted, there's no reason they had to shut down, but nobody wanted to do business with them.
Right, so, and that's that. That is that.
Lose 100% of your customers, you have a pretty bad business.
That's right, yeah, pretty bad. It's 98% you have a bad business. All right, so my last two questions. One is, you work with a lot of organizations on culture of innovation. What is their moment, their catalyst for actually picking up the phone and calling you? What do you hear from them in that first conversation?
Usually what happens is they started doing all the traditional methods. Mm-hmm. We had a suggestion box. Mm-hmm. We got 1,000 ideas and we implemented them. And for 6 months, it was great.
Yeah.
Now we've got a problem. Mm-hmm. And it's predictable. I remember I was doing one event where they just started. They brought me in and they just started doing an idea management system, a suggestion box. And he said, Steve, loved your conversation about challenges, but our idea system is awesome. It's working. It's beautiful. It's a I look forward to a call from you in 9 months. Almost on the dot, I get a call 9 months later. You know, our idea system, we got a problem. And the issue is the noise increases, the quality decreases, fewer and fewer things get implemented, which means then fewer people want to participate, and it becomes this death spiral. So that's in many cases when I get called, or it's just a company recognizes in the market they're struggling to compete.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're not competing, innovation is the reason. Innovation will solve, in my opinion, biased opinion, could solve a sales problem, a leadership problem, a marketing problem. Innovation ties into all of those. And so to me, if you aren't innovating, that's probably the reason why you're not succeeding.
Well, that's the beauty of innovation. It is really not about the outcome. It's about the process. So you can apply it anywhere. Exactly. And where you're faltering. It doesn't have to. I mean, I think a lot of people think of it as new product development or new service development, but that's just a tiny piece of it, actually.
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah. All right, great. So the last question is, how should people get in touch with you, find you? Obviously, go to Amazon and buy the book, but beyond that.
I mean, the easiest thing is just go to my website, which is stevenshapiro.com with a PH, or Steve Shapiro. Everybody knows how to spell Steve. So it's stevenshapiro.com. Just go there. And you can find all my details and books and videos and everything else there.
Well, this has been incredibly fun. And I wish we had 2 more hours. So I might have to have you back to do another conversation. So thank you so much. I have no doubt that the roundtable is going to get a lot out of it.
I had a blast. Thank you.
Thanks for hanging out with us inside Launch Street. When you're ready to take your game to the next level, join the thousands of others that are upping their innovation edge on GoToLaunchStreet.com, the top online education resource and community platform for innovators looking to use innovation to get measurable results. GoToLaunchStreet.com.